I'd like to welcome everyone today to our audio conference workshop entitled Ethics and Social Work Practice, Evangelism, Prayer, Value Conflicts, and Other Issues in the Ethical Integration of Personal Beliefs and Professional Practice. This will be presented by David Sherwood, editor of Social Work and Christianity and professor of social work at Baylor University. Dr. Sherwood is also a member of the Commission on Accreditation of the Council on Social Work Education. Today's audio conference will explore the use as well as limits of the Social Work Code of Ethics and biblical teachings to resolve ethical dilemmas, identify ethical principles that guide social work practice in regard to spirituality and religion, and assess and use spiritual and religious resources in practice with clients. Before we begin the session, just a few brief housekeeping items. One, you'll have noticed that at this point we're in what's called mute function, and we do that to eliminate any background noise, so you won't at this point in time be able to make any comments or raise questions, although we will at different intervals throughout the conference enter into a live mode so that we will be able to have discussion. But we hope you can understand and appreciate our need to break down the background noise until that time that we have question and answer sessions. Secondly, when we do have questions and answers, if you can do your best to keep your questions and comments crisp and to the point, we have over 50 people participating today, and so want to keep the session moving as good a pace as we can. And then lastly, we had a very brief discussion about David's outline on our website. If for some reason you're not able to access that, if you can email me here at the NACSW office, I'll send it to you either for your use during the conference or afterwards. And again, I'll send it directly attached to an email that you would send to me at info@nacsw.org. So without any further ado, I'm delighted to present our speaker, David Sherwood.
Hi, this is David again. Obviously, from the introduction, there's a very tall order that we'll do the best we can to cover as much of it as we can. And we'll use the PowerPoint presentation as a kind of outline, and we'll see how well we can move through this, and if there are particular places we might need to linger and try to expand a little bit more, do that. But if you're looking at the PowerPoint, we'll start with slide number 2. The first one is just a title page. And so the statement here, if you can see it, is integration of faith and practice is easy to misunderstand. And so I start by saying it's not a couple of things, at least in my opinion. It's not a uniquely Christian form of social work. And I would also say that it is not learning how to impose our beliefs and values on clients or to evangelize. That may sound like kind of a loaded way to say it, but these are some of the stereotypes, I think, that some people have, and you use an expression like integration of faith and practice, that somehow this is something that just Christians do, and that it involves learning how to surreptitiously evangelize or to impose values. And so I'm trying to say up front that I don't believe that that's what it's about at all. The next slide, we're on slide 3 now, I guess. Integration of faith and practice, I think, has at least 3 different senses. And at least in my opinion, all social workers, regardless of their beliefs, whether they're Christian or not, whether they believe in God or not, should be doing the first 2. In other words, yes, I believe that atheists should be integrating their faith and practice in an ethical and an appropriate way, and that few social workers, including few Christians, will likely be doing the third kind of integration that I'm thinking about. So now we're on to the next slide, which is slide 4, I guess. So kind of the first big statement, integration of faith and practice, I think in its most basic meaning, is the critical understanding of how our own beliefs, whatever they are, our own values, whatever they are, and worldview, whatever it is, and how that affects our professional perceptions and actions. So that's why I say that even if you don't believe in God, that is a form of worldview, that is a belief system, that is a type of faith. And you need to be thinking about how you integrate that in an ethical and appropriate way in your work with people. So I guess that kind of tips my hand up front as a very significant aspect of where I'm coming from. You know, we use words like professional use of the self, and this we're now on to slide five, I guess. That the idea that there's something that we do in social work and other helping professions, that it's not just technique, it's not just technology, it's not just information, but our self is kind of the vehicle through which all of this gets embodied and related and accomplished. And so when we're dealing with issues of spirituality and religion or values and ethics, it's the same thing. This is not something different. This is a normal part of the process. Now I'm going to some subheads under this, and I don't know whether that's a different slide for you guys or not. It's still number five, basically. I'm saying that there's no such thing as value-free or objective social workers. Now, back in the 1970s, I got my MSW, that was kind of the party line. That was what I was taught, that social workers should be value-free and that we should be objective, and that, you know, that really, certainly our values, but really values in general, were not something that we were supposed to be messing with, or that certainly spirituality and religion was not something we should be, quote, messing with as far as our social work practice is concerned. What I'm saying is that there's no such thing as a value-free or objective social workers. We all have values, and they always impact the way we perceive and practice. So I'm saying that the only question is, how do we deal with these values and these assumptions, these beliefs, in an ethical and a competent way? And this applies across the board. I'm arguing that this is not a Christian endeavor exclusively, or for someone who is has spiritual beliefs, particular religious beliefs, but it is an issue for all social workers regardless. Okay, moving to the next point I hear that, and this applies to whether I'm dealing with clients who are similar to me or with clients who are possibly radically different from me, the same thing still applies. Okay, next slide, number six, I guess. As we think about what critical self-awareness involves, at least for me, I think about what are some of my core beliefs and values and assumptions. We use the word or expression sometimes worldview. What are my basic assumptions, basic beliefs about what kind of a universe this is? Why should some things be done and some things not be done? Or is there any guidance along those kinds of lines? Or are values completely subjective, completely relative, completely culturally conditioned? These are the kinds of things that all of us carry around with us, no matter who we are. And that it's very important for us to be aware of these and how they shape the way we interpret the world around us, how they affect the way we interpret what our clients are doing or saying at the same time. So subhead under that, how do they affect my work with clients? These beliefs, these basic assumptions that I take for granted or that kind of set the parameters of the kind of perceptions that I have, that I make. And as I've already indicated, these can be spiritual, religious, ideological, or theoretical for that matter. The expression meta-narrative, kind of fancy way of saying a big story, the big story that we use to make sense out of our experience of life. For myself, I am a Christian. I identify myself as a Christian. And so, as a Christian, I identify with I have a big meta-narrative that I use to make sense out of my experience of the world. That there's a big story starting biblically in the Old Testament and going through the New Testament that I see my story as a part of, and that bigger story out there shapes and gives meaning as I understand, my small story within that. And I'm suggesting that there's no one who's exempt from this. We all have stories, meta-narratives that we use to make sense out of our experience of life. And that story might be a Christian one. It might be an Islamic one. It might be a materialist, naturalistic one that says, you know, there's nothing exists beyond the physical, and that there is no purpose or meaning. We kind of discover ourselves with the ability to have sensory impressions and so forth, and we respond to those, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's a meta-narrative, or a part of a narrative about what kind of a universe this is, what is real, what is not real, what has value, or what value means. And I'm suggesting that all of us need to be very much engaged in trying to understand that. Next slide. Hello, my name is David, and I'm a Christian. You know, that sounds like the beginning of an AA meeting. Well, and I'm not saying that we should greet all of our clients with that kind of an introduction, but in a certain kind of a sense, I guess maybe I almost am, that certainly for ourselves, and we think about informed consent, you know, when we work with people, well, we at least need to be aware that I am David and I'm a Christian, and how does that affect how I understand and work with people. Or I'm a Buddhist, or I'm an agnostic, or I'm a logical positivist, or I'm a behaviorist. So, or I'm a liberal Democrat, or I'm a truly conservative Republican, a real Republican, or for that matter, I'm a real Christian as opposed to some others that I might name. The next slide, this is number 8, I guess. This is a quotation that I've gotten secondhand. This is Jeff Galper. Some of you may recognize that name. He taught social work at Temple University for a number of years, well-known writer, social activist, and so on. Lawrence Ressler tells the story about his experience as a student in Jeff's classes at Temple University back, I guess, in the 70s, sometime back there, maybe not quite that long ago. But he said that Galper came into class the first day and announced this. He said, "I'm a Marxist and I teach from a Marxist perspective." And, you know, that's, whoa, can you do that? Can he say that? I mean, can he be ethical and competent and do such a thing? Well, my response is, well, it depends. Maybe. Maybe he's being more ethical than if he didn't come in and say that. Because he was a Marxist, and he did teach from a Marxist perspective. And, you know, it did help to understand that. Now then, was he ethical or not? That depends. Just as it would be if I were to announce to my class at Baylor University, I'm David, and I'm a Christian, and I teach from a Christian perspective. I do. But am I ethical in the way I do that, or am I unethical? Well, that remains to be seen. And it's how do you do that? So a test I would suggest is, how conscientious was he in not imposing this view on his students? Was it possible to be in his class and not to be a Marxist, or not to accept a Marxist interpretation, and still get an okay grade, or even a good grade? Be treated respectfully? Was he able to accept, permit, or even facilitate disagreement in his classes? Those are the questions that would tell me whether or not he was being competent and ethical, not whether or not he had a worldview and whether or not it affected the way he taught. We all have worldviews, and they always affect the way we teach or practice. Second point here about, you know, we're talking about what is integration of faith. Another kind of integrating faith and practice is a very important one, and it's a more day-to-day kind of thing, not that the other one isn't. but integration of faith and practice can be the deliberate, skillful taking into account of the spiritual and religious beliefs of clients and other relevant systems in social work practice. And at this point, we're on slide number 9. This is, I think, just competent practice with diversity, spiritual and religious diversity. And this is the large bulk of what most of us will be doing, whether we practice among people who have a similar faith or belief system that we do, or whether we practice with people who have quite diverse and different beliefs that we may have. So I would argue that competent social workers will, in fact, deal with spirituality and religion. We're on to slide 10 now. And they will either do it well or badly. And so we ought to prepare to do it as ethically and skillfully as we can. Maybe I should stop, Rick, at this point and see if anyone has any questions or comments they'd like to
Okay, I'll open up the lines.
Any questions or any comments, disagreements, ideas that anyone would like to toss in at this point? Okay, hearing none, we'll progress on for a while. Okay, Rick? So kind of the next slide, I guess, is number 11, some common fallacies, I think, in dealing with integrating faith and practice and on this level, this level of skillful taking into account the spiritual and religious beliefs of clients and others. One idea is that I'm not spiritual or religious myself, so I can be objective about this. It's you know, the religious people, you know, you have a conflict of interest or something, and so it's only the non-spiritual people that can deal objectively with spiritual issues. And I have seriously heard this argument put forward. I have to seriously question how it can be put forward seriously, that being objective means not having spiritual and religious beliefs. You know, that's a belief. That's a worldview. That's a position. And if people think it's simply an objective fact, that they know the truth about the universe and the rest of us are deluded on this point, I guess I would tend to think of that as kind of proof that they weren't so objective after all. An objective person hopefully would understand that they do have a point of view and that it does impact the way they think. So, I don't think that the way we are objective is having not having an opinion on the subject. We all have opinions on most subjects, one way or another. But how do we handle those beliefs and how do we handle those opinions is a much more important question. Another idea that I'm calling a fallacy, it says, since I'm not religious or my religion is different from my clients, I therefore have no business getting into this stuff. So avoid or refer. This is kind of an equal and opposite kind of error in a way, I would think, because we can't excuse ourselves from dealing with clients who are different from us. You know, this is a kind of thinking that you know, we just wouldn't accept in any other area. Another idea that I think some Christians have, and others as well, since my client has the same religion as I do, this will be easy. That's not been my experience. Sometimes the hardest clients that I've had to deal with are ones who had the same religious beliefs in general, at least, that I did. So the idea that either that we don't have the same belief, therefore we can't work with people, or we do have the same belief, so therefore it's easy, I think are both mistaken. So with that in mind, let's move on, kind of summarizing a little bit here, that the idea that addressing spiritual and religious issues is a part of normative, holistic practice. One of the encouraging things in the field of social work in the last 5, 10, even 15 years has been kind of rediscovering this basic concept that we can't just bracket spiritual and religious issues, and that on a certain level it is a part of normative practice. So this is, I think, an encouraging sign. Just like any other potentially important or unimportant dimension of a client's life, spiritual issues may be important in the work that we do with a particular client, or it may have absolutely no particular relevance in this particular case. Just like race or gender or ethnicity or culture may or may not be highly relevant in a particular case. That's something we have to find out. And the addressing of this is always interactive with a variety of things, such as meaning and purpose, values, goals, behavior, gender, sexuality, strengths, resources, barriers, challenges, community and societal structures, religious and spiritual beliefs, value beliefs interact with all of these other things, and that's part of what makes it so fascinating and also so complex. Okay, well, this is the third kind of integration that I'd mentioned earlier, and this is the one that I don't think most of us get into, although some of us do, and that is the idea of integration of faith and practice as developing a particular spiritual or religious form of practice. Some people think this is the exclusive idea or exclusive definition, and I guess I'm arguing that it's a possible definition, but it's a less common and maybe relevant for some of us in some of the contexts in which we work, but probably for most of us, this is not what we're going to be meaning by integrating faith and practice. When we're talking about this, we're talking about the explicit incorporation of theological concepts and spiritual religious practices within the work that we do. And there are some of us in faith-based contexts and so forth, or private practice, for which this might possibly be the form that our practice or our integration would take. I'm suggesting some of the things that might be advisable in these kind of contexts would be clear informed consent on the part of clients, that kind of they know what we are doing and that they understand that in advance and they consent to it. Appropriate auspices, such as a faith-based organization or a particular kind of private practice or something like this. And I would also argue accountability structures beyond ourselves. One of the problems in, we're very entrepreneurial in the United States, and we're very individualistic, and we kind of like to set up and on our own. And one of the problems with that is we don't sometimes have enough accountability or other folks to kind of get us back on track if we start veering off. And I think particularly when we're developing what we perceive to be very explicit theological concepts, spiritual religious practices as a part of our work with clients, this is an area where we probably need even more accountability than in some other areas which are more kind of normative or common aspects of practice. The critical issue we're dealing with is respecting the rights and freedoms of our clients on the one hand, while maintaining personal integrity with our own beliefs on the other hand. And I think that's a tension and a process that we are always going to be involved in. And it's not a simple thing, but I'm suggesting that we're not just kind of shooting in the dark, playing pin the tail on the donkey with this either, that guidance is available. I think from my perspective, we do have guidance in the Bible and in Christian theology and in the church. I think we also have professional sources of guidance as well, and certainly the NASW Code of Ethics would be a definite one of those. Rick, let's pause again and see just for a second and see if there's any comments or questions.
Oh. David, this is Amy Lynn in California.
Yes.
And hello. Could you again stress, I didn't quite get in my head the tension between the two things you just now mentioned. Could you redo that?
The tension between what?
Yeah, I didn't... You know, you were talking about just now, and you said there's a tension in the process between the things, and I missed the
tension. Oh, I think just respecting our clients as what were the exact words that I was saying. You know, the rights and freedoms of our clients, and at the same time having integrity with our own beliefs. I think that's a tension that we feel. In
right.
other words, I mean, that's one of the places that is classically comes up. What if my clients are doing something I believe is wrong? Or that it would seem that in order to do what my clients want me to do, I would have to do something that I think is wrong. That's one of those kinds of areas where we struggle with tension. And I don't think we'll ever fully resolve that, but I think, and some of the things we'll be talking about today, hopefully will be helpful in helping us to wrestle with that in a way that, I guess the key word here is integrity. Integrity professionally, but also personally. At least a lot of folks that I encounter experience that as an issue. And I would argue that it's not just Christians. I think anyone, if they're in practice long enough, will find clients going down paths that they feel very conscientiously objecting to. Even the most, whatever we want to, what kind of words we would want to use, the person who describes themselves as a relativist in values really normally is not. You can't be a social worker ultimately, I think, and be a complete relativist. Or you can't accept the code of ethics, because the code of ethics says we have certain moral obligations to respect the dignity and worth of each person, for example. And a moral relativist can't say that. I don't know whether that's helpful or not, but...
Very helpful. Thank you.
Anything else right now? Okay, well, let's press forward a little bit more. The Code of Ethics gives us a mandate on this, and we're going to spend a little bit of time going through some of the areas of the Code of Ethics that talk about this balancing of personal values and respecting the values and beliefs of our clients. This is a quotation from the preamble. This is slide number 17, I guess. Social workers also should be aware of the impact on ethical decision-making of their clients and their own personal values and the cultural and religious beliefs and practices. They should be aware of any conflicts between personal and professional values and deal with them responsibly. Exactly. That's what I believe and what I'm saying. And, you know, in my perspective, this is a very biblical point of view. Pressing on, there's a few examples from the Code of Ethics. This is slide number 18, I guess. 1.05 deals with cultural competency and social diversity. And A says, social workers should understand culture and its function in human behavior and society, recognizing the strengths that exist in all cultures. So that's part of our professional mandate. I would also argue that we would have this mandate, or I would have this mandate based on my biblical worldview as well. B says social workers should have a knowledge base of their clients' cultures and be able to demonstrate competence in the provision of services that are sensitive to clients' cultures and to differences among people and cultural groups. So, again, I just simply underscore this. It's in the Code of Ethics, and I think it provides some principal guidance along some of these issues that we're dealing with. Next slide is part C, which says social workers should obtain education about and seek to understand the nature of social diversity and oppression with respect to race, ethnicity, national origin, color, sex, sexual orientation, age, marital status, political belief, religion, and mental or physical disability. And especially if we're going to be dealing with particular groups that are represented, and especially as these groups differ from us. Now, are we ever able to have full understanding? No. So therefore, the need to approach our understanding of other people, holding our understandings lightly and open to interpretation and clarification and correction by our clients. I like the expression that assuming a position of not knowing with our clients, having them help us to understand what these beliefs or these differences mean to them, as opposed to what we might have read in our textbooks. Although there's value in reading those textbook chapters about practice with X, Y, or Z particular group, it has limited value. So I think I've already said this, deliberately avoiding these kinds of issues, spiritual and religious issues, is a form of incompetence, professional incompetence, based on the code of ethics. What other important area of clients' lives would social workers condone a policy of avoidance, withdrawal, or referral? That's a rhetorical question. I don't think there are any. And similarly, with spirituality and religion, with values and ethics, these are areas that we just have to deal with. So that's not the question, but to deal with them as competently and ethically as we can. I am indeed arguing that it can't be evangelism or imposing values, whatever our values are. We think of evangelism typically in terms of persons with certain religious perspectives trying to recruit others into that belief. But I've known a lot of social workers with a lot of different kind of ideologies and beliefs that they were highly tempted to recruit others into. Sometimes they didn't call it evangelism. Sometimes they called it, say, consciousness raising. But it kind of amounted to the same thing. Dealing with these issues with clients must be client-focused and client-led, not our agenda, but truly the client's agenda. A few slides here dealing with some basic differences between spirituality and religion. This is commonplace kind of stuff in the literature these days, especially like Ed Kanda and many others who have written and discussed. These are complex issues, but in general, this kind of distinction is made, that spirituality is a broad idea, the human sense of and search for transcendence, meaning, and connectedness beyond the self, a very broad, inclusive kind of definition. Some definitions have more specific connection to more theistic ideas, but it's usually a fairly broad definition at this point. Transcendence and meaning beyond the self. This is one of Kanda's statements. The basic human drive for meaning, purpose, and moral relatedness among people with the universe and with the ground of our being. Religion, on the other hand, is a more particular and structured kind of a concept. Usually refers to more formal organization embodiment of spirituality and into relatively specific belief systems or practices, organizational structures. So churches, denominations, more systematic theologies of one sort or another generally are defined under this category. And so Kanda, again, he uses the expression, an institutionally patterned system of beliefs, values, and rituals. Going to segue into another thing that this, something that I talk about a lot with my students. And some of you may have read in some of the things that I've put in the Social Work and Christianity Journal, but this is helpful to me as I think about how we have guidance, but at the same time we ultimately have to make judgments about practice. And so a little bit of alliteration here, the practice principle pyramid. And basically what this is about for me is a way of thinking about how on the one hand at a generalized or abstract level we can have a fair amount of agreement, but as we get closer and closer to more specific case situations, even conscientious persons who have the same principles are going to find themselves with greater levels of disagreement. So it's a way that helps me think about the relationship between worldview assumptions, core values, codes of ethics, and specific cases. as I said, there's greater agreement on basic values at the conceptual level. We believe in justice, for example. We believe that we should address issues of poverty. But how do we do that? What does justice look like in various kinds of contexts? I had a group of students earlier this morning, and we were discussing organ donation and organ transplants, and what is justice in procuring and distributing a scarce resource such as kidneys and livers and hearts. You know, we agree that we ought to be fair. Well, what is fair? Is it fair that someone who's an alcoholic and shows no signs of changing their behavior should receive a liver, for example, or not? Or maybe it's fair in one way, but it's maybe not so just in another kind of way. Anyway, the point being that there's greater room for conscientious and practical disagreement among all of us as we become increasingly more specific in regard to policies, programs, and practice decisions. You know, God may not be a Democrat or a Republican, but many of us are one or the other. And it isn't simply a matter of, well, Republicans or Democrats don't believe in justice, but perhaps they have different ideas about how justice is achieved or how to prioritize various values that come into tension as we try to achieve justice. So here's my little pyramid. I hope that you can see it on the slide. I guess this is slide 25. See it down at the bottom, you have this big foundation, the kind of the bases, and these are the worldview beliefs and assumptions. Then on top of that is core principles, values, then rules, then cases. So I'm going to talk about them briefly, quickly. But the part of the symbolism of the pyramid is that as you get up to the top, the area covered is smaller. And so the level of agreement between conscientious social workers or conscientious Christians is probably going to be less as we get up to that point and have to make a tough judgment about a particular dilemma. So at the bottom of the pyramid is the bases, and this is kind of moving on to slide 26. These are our fundamental beliefs. What kind of a universe is this? Is there such a thing as a God? Is our values relative or absolute in some kind of a sense? You know, is there meaning or is the universe absurd? You know, what does it mean to be a person? Do persons really do have intrinsic meaning and value? That's what the Code of Ethics says. I would say that's what the Bible says. But, you know, not all worldviews have that idea. And you don't have to be if you don't believe in that, doesn't mean you're stupid, but, you do have a different idea about the nature of the universe. What is the nature of values and the good? Is it just subjective, or is there something ultimately absolute? Is there something written into the nature of the universe that makes some values kind of really real on some level? And what do we know and how do we know it? These are some basic worldview kind of questions. And that whether we have these explicitly, formally thought out, all of us walk around carrying these in our head. Maybe we just got them off of television, or we got them from Sunday school, or we got them from our parents. Or maybe we really have done a lot of serious thinking about them. I hope it's the latter. But even if we've done a lot of serious thinking about them, that doesn't mean that they're all clear and all straight. But we do have them, and they do affect us. And so these basic core beliefs, assumptions. So my Christian faith interacts very much with my worldview, shaping it and being shaped by it. And this is one of the ideas that I think is important, that yes, we have these assumptions, and they are the filters that we bring to a situation, but at the same time, as we encounter the world and situations, that has an influence back on us and may modify or reshape somewhat our understandings and our worldview, hopefully in the long run for the better, but always there is some kind of effect. The next level up is kind of the principal level. And at this point, we're talking about, you know, core values. In the Christian terminology, biblical terminology, I would say exceptionless absolutes that always apply, always true, no exceptions. And I would say things like love and justice. The Bible says that God is love. The Bible says that God is just. And there is no time when that is not a relevant consideration. These are the axes on which the universe revolves in terms of values. And everything else kind of, in my understanding of the Bible, flows from these. Other people with other worldviews may describe their core beliefs or their core values in some kind of different way. I just believe that, you know, everybody's good and that is, you know, given the chance, we'll move towards that goodness, whatever the idea might be. Another way to think about these principles when you relate them to the code of ethics would be, if you look at the core values of social work, they're enumerated in the code of ethics. There are about six, such as service, social justice, the dignity and worth of the person, the importance of human relationships, integrity, competence. These are overarching kind of principles that have their application in lots of different areas. So then the next step up in the pyramid is kind of the rule level. Based on our principles, we develop kind of rules to guide the application of those principles. Fancy word for this, deontological. The idea of ought, obligation, is rooted here. The idea that there are things that should be done or should not be done. And they derive from these principles and they guide the application of the principles in various areas of life. For example, the Ten Commandments or the Sermon on the Mount in the Bible would be some examples of rules, truth-telling, keeping promises, providing for the needs of others. These are rules, you know, you're faithful to your spouse. You don't cheat in business deals. These are oughts. These are rules, and they grow out of love and justice from a Christian perspective, or from a social work perspective. They grow out of social justice, competence, service, etc. And a lot of folks, including the church that I grew up in, I don't know about your church, but, you know, kind of think that we can make a rule that kind of covers every situation, and that the Bible does that, and that the code of ethics does that. If you just kind of know what the Bible says, it will tell you what to do when you have these moral dilemmas or when you have these practice dilemmas. If you know what the code of ethics says, you will have all the instruction you need to be invariably ethical in practice if you just do what it says. Well, here's where it kind of gets more complicated from my point of view, because the next step up, we get into where these principles begin to conflict with each other. And so this is at the case level. At the case level, you have specific practice situations where the rules can and do come into tension or conflict with one another. And so I have more than one rule in the Bible, or I have more than one rule in the code of ethics that applies to the situation, and kind of any course of action is going to be challenged in regard to this. And an example from the Code of Ethics would be, we have rules about confidentiality. We also have rules about a duty to warn. There are case situations where any course of action that's open to you is going to have to prioritize one or the other of those, that something's going to have to give. Now, most of us would like to believe that that wouldn't be the case, that we could just stick with confidentiality and we wouldn't have to worry about doing something unethical. But the world is not that simple for us, and I would say fallen and finite creatures. When we find ourselves in the complexity of a practice situation, knowing what is going to be the most right thing that's available for us to do under the circumstances. So as I said, any actual course of action will advance some of our rules or values at the expense of some or other values and the rules that go with them. And so it is with welfare reform. So it is with health care legislation. So it is with child protection. We have practice situations that any specific program or any specific policy or any specific rule, even if it's in the Bible or even if it's in the code of ethics, is going to advance some of our values at the risk or cost of some of the other values that we have. That, to me, is the definition of a moral dilemma or of an ethical dilemma. And that's where we find ourselves many times in practice, even if we would rather believe that that's not the case. So this kind of brings us to slide number 30, which is Sherwood's maxim. I don't claim any particular originality with this, but I do claim repetition. you can't maximize all values simultaneously. And this is what happens, and this is a situation we find ourselves in practice ethical dilemmas. We have more than one value at stake, and any action is going to cost us something. And I'd rather that weren't the case, but that really is the case. And that doesn't excuse me from making a judgment and taking an action. But that's, to me, the reality of where we live. And I guess it's important to make a balancing kind of statement here. One is that when it comes right down to it, in the hard ethical situations and value situations we find ourselves in, we're always having to make judgments. We give it our best shot. We bring our best understanding of what the rules are. We have our best understanding of what the facts of the situation are, our best understanding of what the potential consequences are of the various options available. And then we make a choice and we act. But there's risk. There's cost involved in any action in any direction we go. And that's where we live. But, so judgment is inevitable. And so professional judgment, informed in judgment, principled in judgment. But at the same time, we do have principles. We do have guidance. It's not like we're all alone up here. That we do have the code of ethics, and although the code of ethics won't give us the final answer to all these questions, it will give us, point us in the right basic directions, and at least help us understand what the values are that have to be juggled in a given situation. And same way with the Bible. The Bible will give us very strong guidance. Our spiritual beliefs will give us very strong guidance, even though they won't always give us the kind of prescriptive answer that we would like at that case level. So, kind of whether we like it or not, we're in the situation, but as I said, the corollary to Sherwood's maxim is you have to come as close as you can, even though you can't maximize all values simultaneously. So that's the paradox, so that's the tension. We do make judgments and we take actions which do prioritize our values one way or the other. Legitimate values do come in conflict and judgments are required, whether we like it or not. And we're on to slide number 31. Every actual policy, program, practice, intervention is some sort of compromise which represents a balancing of competing legitimate but not always equally important values, and that's the rub. We do have to make a judgment. So how do we prioritize? This is slide 32. Well, tough question. We have various rules. Some of you are familiar with Loewenberg and Dolgoff's ethical screen. It's a way of trying to prioritize some of these kinds of values. I won't go into detail about that one right now, but you can look it up if you're not familiar with it. It has value, but it too embodies certain assumptions. It has worldview assumptions baked into it, and they're highly individualistic assumptions that are baked into it. But is it helpful? Yes. Does it give us the exact answers? No, it doesn't. One of the things I would say is that we have to make a judgment about the relative centrality of the various values at stake to our core principles. So what makes most for love and justice under the circumstances, realizing that any action we take is going to compromise some aspect of the Code of Ethics rules, or the Bible rules, for that matter. Number two, the idea of making a judgment about the perceived consequences. Sometimes we think we just follow the rules. We shouldn't even think about consequences. In fact, Immanuel Kant kind of made that into an ethical principle tried to make a highly deontological notion of ethics. That it was highly unethical to think about consequences. Well, I would argue no. Yeah, we have to know the deontological part. What are the rules? What are the values at stake? But part of that is also looking at the perceived consequences as best we can understand them. But part of the rub with looking at perceived consequences is the time we make our ethical decisions, it's not about what has actually happened, it's about what we think it's going to happen. And we can be really wrong about that, as much as we try. But we have to bring that to bear. We can't just ignore the consequences. And the consequences are not irrelevant to maximizing love and justice in a difficult situation. So when we have differences at the case level, it's certainly affected by our worldview and our interpretation of the situation. If your understanding of what it means to be a person will definitely affect your beliefs or attitude towards abortion, euthanasia, the relative value of personal freedom versus the common good and social responsibility. And I think this is what, frankly, in my opinion, a lot of conservative Christians these days are not struggling with enough. They've picked a couple of these values, such as abortion, for example, perhaps, and maybe personal freedom, but maybe are not looking as much as they might need to at the common good and social responsibility that are equally biblical values and equally social work values. But that's a free editorial comment at this point. Even when we've done our best, we're fallen and finite. We're not going to be able to predict. We have limited ability to gain the knowledge of the facts and to make good judgments, but make them we must do. Kind of summarizing this section, the Code of Ethics in the Bible have definite value, but they also have definite limits in guiding our practice. One way to say it for me is that they give us critical guidance and direction, but not prescriptive formulas. They point us in the direction, they highlight the issues and the values that are at stake, but they will not tell us exactly what to do in tough case situations, because precisely they come into tension with each other. Case-level judgments are required because not all of the values can be fully achieved and not all of the rules completely followed. Practice in this world is always approximation, but we have to choose and act. Let me move on because of time to the next slide. This is a quotation of the Code of Ethics. This is number 36 for those of you who are needing the numbers. It says, the core values and the principles that flow from them must be balanced within the context and complexity of human experience. The Code offers a set of values, principles, and the standards to guide decision-making and conduct when ethical issues arise. It does not provide a set of rules that prescribe how social workers should act in all situations. Specific applications of the Code must be taken into account, or must take into account the context in which it is being considered, and the possibility of conflicts among the Code's values, principles, and standards. Amen. Precisely, and it's in that this is in the preamble to the Code of Ethics. It goes on to say, the NASW Code of Ethics does not specify which values, principles, and standards are most important and ought to outweigh others in instances where they conflict. Reasonable differences of opinion can and do exist among social workers with respect to the ways in which values, ethical principles, and ethical standards should be rank-ordered when they conflict. Ethical decision-making in a given situation must apply the informed judgment of the individual worker. Finally, it says, ethical decision-making is a process. There are many instances in social work where simple answers are not available to resolve complex ethical issues. Social workers should take into consideration all the values, principles, and standards in this code that are relevant to any situation in which ethical judgment is warranted. Social workers' decisions and actions should be consistent with the spirit as well as the letter of this code. Again, anyone have anything they'd like to raise or discuss about what we've covered so far?
Okay, David, every lines are open.
Okay, any questions?
I might have closed them back off. Hold on.
Any questions or comments?
Anyone there?
We're here.
Well, you're there. All right, great. Well,
now the lines are really open.
Yeah. Are there any questions or comments anyone wants to raise at this point before we plunge on?
Hello.
Okay. Well, let's move on then.
Okay. I thought I heard one person.
Yeah.
Start.
Oh, was there? Okay. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that there are specific things, for instance, sexual conduct of social workers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So some of them, it is pretty clear.
Some of the rules are definitely prescriptive. Yeah.
Okay.
And in the Code of Ethics and in the Bible, for that matter.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is that there can be times and situations
when
in which some of these come into tension with others.
Yes.
And I'm not necessarily referring to the sexual ones right now.
Right.
Although there's definitely conflict or difference of opinion about those among many social workers as well. But again, in a class this morning, the same one I was referring to earlier, we were talking about dual relationships. And the Code of Ethics has several fairly specific things to say about dual relationships. But on the one hand, it says don't do it, and the other hand, it says, but when you do, here's some guidelines. And that's the truth, because there are many situations, especially in rural or small town areas, where it would be incompetent not to engage in dual relationships. But you have to do it very carefully. So there is guidance in the Code of Ethics about that, but you have to make complex judgments about, okay, I'm going to enter into this dual relationship, but what are some ways that I can protect the client, protect myself, et cetera, in a way that is responsible.
Okay.
I think you're presenting very good guidelines that are helpful in working through very, very difficult issues. And in this country, we see a lot of quick and easy answers. You were using the abortion issue, for example.
I'm tempted. I love love that. But congenitally or some other way, I'm also, there's something in my head that always says, but how about this? How about that other thing?
Yeah, because when you're dealing with clients, then all those other yeah buts come in. There is, a sanctity of life, but mother's life may also be in danger if she continues the pregnancy. And,
exactly.
And on, you can go with any situation that you presented in a society where people just tend to take a very superficial, this is always right or this is always wrong, and people
exactly.
have these black and white answers. We know as social workers, it's just not that simple. It never is that simple, but this lays out how to kind of look at all those issues and...
Right, and it's not about leaving behind those values and those rules, but it's taking them along with us, but realizing that there are going to be places where they inform us, but they can't prescribe.
And and they may inform us, but we not necessarily prescribe to the client who's sitting before us.
Exactly, because they have their responsibilities, and we have to respect their freedom as well. And so, yes, that's very much a part of it.
Thank you.
All right. Any other comments or questions?
David, can I voice one on behalf of a member who had written to me recently?
Absolutely.
And I think this relates to something you're going to talk about later, so maybe it's just a framing question that you,
right.
you would choose to answer later.
Yeah.
But this person says something that concerns her is when there's an attempt to integrate ethical social work values with Christian beliefs, the tension that's most difficult for her is this. In an example where a client is despairing, wondering about the purpose of their life, wondering why they should kill themselves or even go on living at all, they're concerned that a presentation like this makes it sound that it would not be ever appropriate to tell a client about how Jesus offers hope and can change life.
Ooh.
Let me go on. This person goes on to say there are times as a Christian that they believe God does put before them someone who needs to hear the gospel. And this person says she would never in any way push their beliefs on someone else. But when someone is asking for hope and clearly has nothing to live for, in the client's own words, how can it be ethical for the person and how can they live with themselves by simply offering sort of standard social work responses or anything except what they believe in their heart of hearts could be meaningful and helpful to the client. And again, I say that it's one of the most difficult challenges, but this is not a naive social worker.
Oh, I understand. Absolutely.
Right. And again, whether you choose to respond now or later when you go, talk about that, I thought that would be very helpful to hear you sort of sweat.
yeah. Okay, well, no, that's very good. And I will say a word or two now. And a part of what I'll say now is that in case we run out of time, which we may well do before we get to the end of, you know, slide 82 or whatever it is in this process, that the latter section of the PowerPoint presentation has some specific materials around levels of intensity in dealing with these kinds of moral and spiritual issues. And, you know, and raises these kinds of questions in a very, I think, nuanced kind of way that starts from a very low level of intensity of dealing with to a potentially very high level of intensity, which would possibly be very rare, but might not, should not be completely excluded. And so, that's a little bit of a preamble or also just a, encouragement in case we do run short on time and have to hurry through the last part. There is a section that kind of outlines some ways of thinking about this, which I think are pretty responsible and pretty balanced, and acknowledge the fact that it's not as simple as just saying, oh, you just keep it to yourself. You know, the theme that I mentioned earlier was integrity with your own beliefs as well as the client's beliefs and freedom. And it is a tension at times, and sometimes it's a very high level of challenge. And there are cases where this would be. And so, consonant with my idea about the principal practice pyramid, my guess is that we're up into some of these hard case situations where we're trying to balance these different values and goods, where some of us would come to different conclusions about what to do or what not to do in regard to that. But I, for one, would not absolutely rule out the idea that it may indeed be the right judgment. That, you know, it would be malpractice for me not to at least offer some possible hope here. And not that I'm trying to evangelize this client, but I am trying to at least give them one other way to think about the situation they're facing. So yeah, that's complicated. Well, with that as an introduction, let's move into it. There's another thing just as we leave the Code of Ethics. This is another quote which I also really like. It talks about this is slide 39, I guess, and 40. That again, the current Code of Ethics, NASB Code of Ethics, I think is a wonderful document. And the one that we all should be very familiar with, and in the whole thing, and a lot of the quotes that I'm taking here are from the preamble section, which set the framework for understanding the principles that come after. And this is another one of those passages from the preamble. A code of ethics cannot guarantee ethical behavior. Moreover, a code of ethics cannot resolve all ethical issues or disputes or capture the richness and complexity involved in striving to make responsible choices within a moral community. Rather, a code of ethics sets forth values, ethical principles, ethical standards to which professionals aspire and by which their actions can be judged. In the next slide, social workers' ethical behavior should result from their personal commitment to engage in ethical practice. The NASW Code of Ethics reflects the commitment of all social workers to uphold the profession's values and to act ethically. And I put the bolding here, but this is from the text. Principles and standards must be applied by individuals of good character who discern moral questions and in good faith seek to make reliable ethical judgments. Amen. So, you know, if you want to really know where it's at, it's about character. It's about what kind of a person am I, what kind of a person am I aspiring to be, and it's constantly enacted in the daily choices, in the daily behaviors, and in the daily kind of reevaluations of choices made, and thoughts about maybe changing choices in the future that an ethical person or a person of good character. A person of good character is not a person who always does the right thing, but it's a person who is desiring and is moving in that direction, who is in the habit of and purposely seeking that good and behaving in accordance with that good as they understand it. And that's what's going to make us ethical or unethical in our practice. And the code of ethics is an auxiliary. It's a tool. But just knowing that and being able to recite it is not going to make us ethical. Kind of like C.S. Lewis said at one point, talking about this kind of thing, he said he'd rather play cards with a bunch of sharpers who were raised to believe that they ought to be honest at cards than with a bunch of moral philosophers or theologians who didn't have that that kind of character. So anyway, let's move along. I'm going to shift into this whole issue of evangelism, and you know, I'm going to make the argument. Obviously, this next slide indicates that evangelism is, and notice I said usually, unethical. And for those of you who have been with us from the beginning, you know that I've been kind of hinting at this all along. And as I say here, I mean evangelism of all kinds, religious, political, ideological, that it's not just the Christians who have this issue. It's all social workers. And it can be called evangelism. It can be called consciousness raising. We can think we're doing it for the good of someone else when we're really doing it to advance what is our agenda. And I think there's some very good reasons, biblically and from the code of ethics and otherwise, to tell us that normally evangelism is unethical. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And here are some of the basic core principles and ethical principles that seem to me that fall into place around this. Pushing us in more than one role. And, you know, I'm using some Christian language here. You know, one of the core values is the Great Commission. And I'll talk about each of these in a little more detail in a minute. But, you know, we have a call to preach the gospel, to bear witness to the good news. We also have the ideas around my calling and my role. We're not all called to be evangelists. Some are called prophets, teachers, evangelists, helpers. Another principle that's relevant here is the idea of self-determination, both from a biblical point of view and from a social work point of view. The ideas of informed consent. Eddie's of integrity. Well, let's take a look at each of these a little bit. Great Commission, you know, Matthew 28:19. We are called to bear testimony to the good news about Jesus' healing and saving work. And in some sense, that's the call of all of us who are disciples of Christ. That we're called to be bear witness to that. And so the kinds of questions that folks raise, that I raise, you know, if the gospel is true, what could be more important for people to hear? That's a real question. And the question that says this value is real to us and explains why we struggle with the question of evangelism in our professional roles, or at least, you know, a lot of my students at Baylor University struggle with this question. Kind of a distinction, and this is certainly not original. I don't claim any originality with any of this. Not original with me, but a useful distinction, I think, in some ways, is the distinction between proclamation of the gospel or the good news versus demonstration of the gospel or the good news. An idea that seems to make sense to me is that it is always professionally ethical and appropriate to demonstrate the gospel to our clients, regardless of who they are and where we are. But it's seldom ethical to proclaim the gospel in our professional roles as social workers. There are exceptions to that. But in general, this would be a way that I would express it. The idea that demonstration, in one sense, is the calling of all Christians. I've got a couple of scriptures here. Ephesians 5, be imitators of God as beloved children and live in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us. Or 1 John 3, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for one another. How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods, sees a brother or sister in need, and yet refuses to help? That's a demonstration of the good news, love and justice. And that's something that I would argue is we're all called to, regardless of who we are. And social work provides unique opportunities to demonstrate the gospel, perhaps preparing the soil for the proclamation side of the gospel. And so I guess at this point we're on slide, 46? I'm losing track of the numbers here a little bit. And as we demonstrate the gospel by doing things that the Code of Ethics tells us to do, I would express it this way, to give clients grace-filled gifts of knowing what it feels like to be treated with love and justice, to be treated with respect and dignity as a person with God-given value. That's demonstrating the gospel in a way that many people have very few experiences of. To be in a respectful, non-exploitive relationship, that's demonstrating the gospel. Give people the opportunity to experience caring, grace, forgiveness, trustworthiness, honesty, and fairness. These are demonstrative aspects of the gospel that there is no limit on our ability to practice. And regardless of the setting we're in, and I would argue we are, persons of faith, absolutely called upon to demonstrate these kinds of things in our work with people, and it doesn't matter where that is. Another relevant principle here is the issue of my calling and role. This is not a novel idea, but it bears repeating. We don't all have the same part to play in a person's life. We don't all have the same part to play in life in general. We do indeed have different gifts and abilities. One of the wonderful things about the profession of social work is that it gives avenues for expressions of many different kinds of gifts, more so than many areas of life. But the New Testament talks about varieties of gifts among the various parts of the body of Christ, and it specifically mentions evangelism in the sense of proclamation as one of those spiritual gifts. And I give some scripture references here. Another one that I refer to is 1 Corinthians 3, 5, and 6. Paul is kind of talking about this process of people coming to faith and growing in faith. And he says, what then is Apollos, or who is Paul? Servants through whom you came to believe, as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. And it may be that the part that we have as professional social workers is not the part of proclamatory evangelism. It doesn't mean we have no part on preparing people to hear and understand the gospel when it is proclaimed to them in a more direct kind of way that does not take advantage of them in their situation. Here's a great quote. This is from Alan Keith Lucas, So You Want to Be a Social Worker, Primer for the Christian Student, available from NACSW. Rick could be glad to help if you don't have a copy of this great little book. Anyway, this is the way Keith put it. Paul said that faith was the gift of the Spirit, which is true. But what we can do as social workers, and we do have a great, wonderful opportunity to do so, is to show such love and forgivingness that a confused and desperate person can understand the Spirit's message when it comes. Consideration of the parable of the sower may be helpful here. The seed only grows to maturity when there is good ground to receive it, but stony or even shallow ground can be converted to good ground by the addition of nutrients, love, or plowing, facing reality, or breaking up of clots, getting rid of blocks. Perhaps what social workers can do for the most part is to be tillers of the ground rather than the sower, who must in the long run be God himself. So that's the way he said it. I think that says it well. Another relevant principle here about evangelism is the idea of professional role and agency, auspice, and function. And as I say on the slide, then this is slide number 49, I guess it is. If you are convinced your calling from God is evangelism in the sense of proclamation, then you should be an evangelist and not a social worker or nurse or car salesman or loan officer. Now, it's true that because of our passion for helping, it's not as simple as that. You know, a person with a passion for helping might be less likely to be a car salesman or some of these other kinds of roles and functions that we may find employment in. But I am kind of serious about this, and this is something that I myself personally have had to struggle with. You know, what is my gift, my calling in the body of Christ? Is it to be an evangelist in the sense of proclamation? I've ultimately come to the conclusion that for myself, mostly, that's not the case. There are cases and there are situations which I am in that kind of a role, but usually not. So if your calling is to convert your clients religiously, politically, or ideologically, whether it's to Christ or to Islam or to feminism or to any other kind of ism, you need to be in a role and an auspice that validates and advertises that, which is not most social work direct practice settings. And again, I want to emphasize, it's not just Christians that have to deal with this issue. There are evangelists who are consciousness raisers who have political and religious agendas that they feel quite free to promote under the guise of social work or helping practice, and feel completely without shame or sanction in that regard. And I think that's a serious issue that needs to be addressed. So this is not just for us religious folks to deal with. It's for all of us to deal with. Story here. This is the next slide. My father-in-law, for many years, demonstrated the grace and love of Christ in his role as a bank teller at the Potter's Bank and Trust. Yes, it really is the Potter's Bank. Not Potter's Savings and Loan, but Potter's Bank and Trust in East Liverpool, Ohio, including taking money out of his own pocket to make sure certain poor customers were able to get at least a little cash at the end of the month. but he could not and did not use his position to hand them tracts with the cash, much less invite them to his church while discussing terms for a loan. As a social worker, you may at times find it appropriate to share your faith directly, but most of the time you won't. One of the most touching experiences of my life was to be at his funeral. He died young, at the age of 60. And to see the people who came to visit the funeral home. And literally, it is kind of a little bit like the story, It's a Wonderful Life. In terms of the lives that he touched in that small town in Ohio by demonstrating the gospel of Christ in his role at the bank, a very humble role. And it literally did. One of the folks who came by the funeral home was, I guess you could say, the town alcoholic, the town drunk, who had a little account there, and he would get up to Don's window and ask Don how much he had in his account, and Don would often look, and really there wasn't anything left, but Don would say $10 and produce $10 for this guy. And he was one of the ones who came. I'm a little emotional here. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that he was being ethical and faithful in his exercise of his role and his auspice. He was a bank teller. He was not an evangelist. But he was bearing witness to the gospel and doing it in a very ethical and appropriate way for his time and place. And so I guess that's kind of a good bottom line for me, trying to understand that. Just to wrap this section up, another principle that we were talking about and that affects here is the idea of self-determination, that theologically Christians are committed to the value of self-determination. One of the remarkable things about the biblical story is that God does not coerce. The picture in Revelation, Jesus stands at the door and knocks. But there's no coercion. It's not forced. The Bible presents a paradox and mystery on our level of understanding, at least, of God's sovereignty and our freedom. Picture of human beings endowed with the gift and responsibility of choice with consequences. God is depicted as calling us but not coercing, warning but not protecting. Conscience and commitment cannot be compelled from a biblical point of view. And that's certainly true as far as the code of ethics as well. Self-determination is a standard growing out of the principle of the inherent worth and dignity of the person. And this is a quote, social workers respect and promote the right of clients to self-determination and assist clients in their efforts to identify and clarify their goals. So if ever a social work value stood on a theological foundation, it is belief in the inherent dignity and worth of every person. And as I see it, God grants us the fearful dignity of self-determination. And we can hardly try to deny it to our clients explicitly or implicitly. As a follower of the code of ethics and as a follower of scripture. So while I may have perceptions of what might be best for my clients, I have no right to compel or manipulate them to that end. That doesn't mean I don't do anything. I do have a responsibility to help facilitate their ability to exercise their self-determination. And that would include exploration of available alternatives and their possible consequences, so that the choices they make are as informed as possible. And so another relevant principle then in this idea of why evangelism isn't normally part of our role is the idea of informed consent. Informed consent essentially means people should know what they're getting into and agree to it. Why are clients coming to your agency or to you? That will differ depending on auspice. Interacts with the thing we talked about before. What expectations do they have? ago. Are they coming to you to get their minds changed, religiously, politically, or ideologically? Again, I raise the question of consciousness raising. Usually that's not the case. And it's a fine line in providing alternatives and options for people to consider and kind of pushing our own agendas. And, you know, I don't think anything we're going to say today is going to solve that. Again, this is part of that self-awareness and conscientious ethical practice that we're talking about here, is being aware of this and not running away from these hard things, but embracing them. So is there anything up front that would lead them to understanding that the sharing of your beliefs would be a likely part of their experience with you? Even explicitly faith-based agencies, there are surprisingly few times when direct evangelism is the appropriate focus or outcome of interaction with the clients. At least that's been my experience. A final issue here that I think we need to consider as we look at this issue of evangelism, a want of integrity. It's a core faith value, and it's a core social work value. We have rules like telling the truth and being trustworthy and keeping agreements. The Code of Ethics talks about conflicts of interest. We should be alert to and avoid conflicts of interest that interfere with the exercise of professional discretion and impartial judgment. And it certainly applies in this kind of a situation. The Code of Ethics speaks about the importance of setting clear, appropriate, and culturally sensitive boundaries and being careful dual or multiple relationships with clients. It says social workers should not take unfair advantage or of any professional relationship or exploit others to further their personal, religious, political, or business interests. Yeah, exactly. So where I come out is that evangelism in the overt proclamatory sense almost always involves the risk of exploiting a vulnerable relationship. It usually involves taking advantage of our professional role and relationship with our clients, and it lacks the integrity of informed consent. I say usually, most always, not always. And I think we need to make that clear. Even when there seems to be a certain consent, or even request from the client to go through the evangelistic door, it's the social worker's responsibility to be the boundary keeper. The social worker, acting in the professional capacity, bears a heavy weight of responsibility to avoid taking advantage of the client's vulnerability. And I think this is really the key issue here in terms of our role and relationship, and why we have to be very careful, even when the clients are giving us what seems to be a very open invitation to come in around these kinds of issues, that it's so easy for us to take advantage of their vulnerability, or take advantage of our situation. And I think it's a very valid ethical principle that we have to, as the professionals, we have to be the gatekeepers, the boundary keepers. This is true in regard to sexual contact. It's true in regard to evangelism.
David, just a quick context.
Yes.
We're at about 20 minutes left.
All right. Well, we'll try to see what we can do here. Thanks for the time reminder, though. This is a little example, and some of you may have seen parts of this before, because I included in some of the writing that I did about it. But suppose a client came to a rape crisis center. This is a publicly funded agency. You're a Christian. She's in a physically and emotionally vulnerable situation. There's nothing about the sign on the door that would lead you to believe that her coming is even giving implied consent to evangelism. She's trusting you for specific kinds of help. The nature of your role and relationship means that you have a special responsibility not to exploit that role. So what you can most certainly do with her is to give the opportunity to experience what it is like to receive grace, love, and justice, what it's like to experience respect, caring, support, trustworthiness, honesty, what it's like not to be taken advantage of, especially for someone in a situation like this. But it would also probably be going much too far to ask her, are you a Christian, when you're doing your assessment. Even if she said no and you quietly moved on, the question would still hang in the air, coming from a representative of the Rape Crisis Center to a person in a state of vulnerability who had a very particular reason for coming to this agency. So how would she read that? How would it affect her response? Next slide. However, it might be quite competent and ethical professional practice to use a more appropriate probe, which could be stated in non-religious terms. Something like, this must be hard. Is there anything in your life that helps you get through things like this? Then if she mentions something about her spiritual or religious beliefs, you're in a position to make a better judgment about how you might help her, even perhaps engaging spiritual and religious resources. That could be good, spiritually sensitive social work practice. But even then, you would be faced with the necessity of using good assessment skills, discernment, and judgment. For example, you would think that praying with clients and Christian agencies would obviously be the right thing to do. Again, this is based on my experience, though. Some clients are religious manipulators and consciously or unconsciously use the appearance of spirituality to avoid dealing with hard issues. So we moved from the Rape Crisis Center. We're now in a spiritually or a religious hospice agency setting, and you have a client that wants to pray. When a client says, let's just pray about that, or I think we just have to trust the Lord, you have to try to discern whether doing that is helpful or their way of avoiding dealing with their anger, fear, abusive behavior, or whatever else they may need to face. So this is the kind of thing, and this illustrates what I mean about judgment, assessment, good social work practice in the context of ethical principles. And, you know, so that it's the best social work practice knowledge and it's best social work practice skills combined with a high level of ethical understanding and integrity as to try to make a judgment about what indeed is the appropriate response. And it might in this agency be to pray with that client, but it might not be the best, most skillful, and most ethical response, even in that kind of setting. So that kind of brings us to the end of this section. Maybe we can take a quick pause, then we'll need to plunge on. But any quick questions?
Okay, lines are open, David.
Anyone want to come in, jump in with something at this point? Got about 18 minutes, I guess, or something left. Something.
Right.
Is there? This is Jerry from Mason, Ohio.
Yeah.
And I was just curious: is there a email address where we can, as I digest this, I'm thinking that there might be some better questions that will come up in the near future. Will we be able to email you with the questions?
Okay. I'm a little bit hesitant to give a blank check on that one. I will answer as best I can, understanding I've got a lot of things I'm behind on. But if you look at the first slide, there is an email address on the title slide, number one, has a address, phone number, and email address. So, yes,
okay.
I will do the best I can.
Okay, and I understand, you know, with the number of people listening that might get a quick response.
Right, and I have a bunch of papers I'm supposed to grade, and
thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Can I make a suggestion, David?
Sure.
This is Amy Lynn in California.
Yeah, hi.
We have a, if you're an NACSW member, which I hope you are, we have a listserv on ethical issues, and then you can have feedback from possibly Dr. Sherwood and possibly a whole lot of other people.
Thanks. That's a very good point. Yeah,
and if anyone needs that listserv email address, just email me at the office at info@nacsw.org, and I'll be glad to forward that to you.
Great. Very good. Well, let's plunge ahead since we are running short on time. I was afraid this is going to happen. It's hard to judge all this and to get through it in a way. This last section is going to deal with some specific suggestions. A lot of this is depending on some material developed by William Dougherty, Dohertty. His name will come up on the slide in a minute. I'm going to run through these next few slides very quickly so I can get to this next material. But kind of the idea of assessing and utilizing spiritual and religious resources in practice. Some guidelines along this line. Number one, explore, but be open to the relevance of spiritual and religious issues, but not force it. They may come up a little, a lot, or not at all. No one size fits all. So again, it's this issue of professional judgment. Number two, try to be informed about various spiritual and religious traditions, but above all, let your clients be your guides. It's the power of not knowing referred to earlier. Treat spiritual and religious issues like you would other issues. Explore their meaning and relevance. Help clients articulate various options. Identify strengths and resources as well as challenges and barriers. Be on the alert how your own beliefs and values might influence your responses, both when you agree and when you disagree. Develop a sense of your limits, refer appropriately, but not prematurely. And that's something we'll talk about more in a minute. Consult with colleagues. We've kind of referred to this before. We've talked about this auspice issue. Be clear how practice auspice, public, private, faith-based, agency function are key variables affecting the assumptions and expectations of clients. Self-disclosure should be sparing and follow the client's lead. This is a quote from Dougherty. Self-disclosure is on some level a request for agreement and appropriation by the client. I think that's right. Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why we really had to be careful. We're role models. We're also persons of power in a situation. And consciously and unconsciously, when we put something out there, as he says, on some level, it's a request for agreement and appropriation by the client. That doesn't say it's overwhelming necessarily, but it does suggest it's something that ought to be taken into consideration. So the idea of collaborative consultation with informed consent around spiritual and religious issues. Just as you would with any request or advice, be careful. There is a time when advice is timely and it's malpractice to withhold it or information. On the other hand, if you've been in practice very much, you know that a request for advice or direction can be very diversionary and serious traps as well and roadblocks to really clients taking responsibility and doing what they need to do. Anyway, let's move on because of the time issue. Spiritual and religious issues can be raised across religious diversity by non-religious language. In other words, if a client has a spirituality that's different from yours, there is language that you can find that will enable at least some basic conversation. And the conflicts can be lessened by looking for overlap areas and common grounds. All right. Degrees of intensity of ethical, religious, and spiritual consultation. This is a quotation from Dougherty. The most intense forms of spiritual discourse are best reserved for extreme cases and require a good degree of empathetic connection or empathic connection beforehand. Yes, indeed. This is a quotation from a reference from Dougherty's work. Here are the two that I'm referring to. Hopefully you're familiar with these. If not, I highly recommend that you take a look at them. They're a little bit controversial. Look at the title of that second one, Soul Searching, Why Psychotherapy Must Promote Moral Responsibility. Whoa, wait a minute. Promote moral responsibility? Well, see what he has to say. We're going to get a flavor of it in a few minutes here. And his article, which has similar kinds of concepts, focusing on spirituality and spiritual resources and family therapy. Dougherty says, a family therapist, not a social worker, but he thinks like a social worker in many ways and brings an interesting perspective to bear on this. And in some ways he speaks with, it's easier for him to say than it would be for me or some of us to say because he's perceived by by professionals at large as maybe less invested in a particular religious tradition. He describes himself his own spirituality is Unitarian, basically. Communitarian, possibly. That's not the same thing as communist, by the way. But anyway, but, you know, he's a very articulate spokesperson, has done some good materials, and there's some videotapes and other kinds of materials that he has available. Anyway, let's just kind of see how far we can get with this. I've taken basically two lists of his and compiled them into one from the respective articles in the book that I just referred to. And it's about 8 or 9 different levels of intensity, starting from the mildest to the most extreme. And the idea that we need to get across is the choice is not A or Z. There's B, C, D, E, F in the middle here. And good practice will modulate and respond. So it's not like we ignore these issues or we jump in with both feet or we withdraw from the case. Although he says we may indeed ultimately find certain situations where we have to conscientiously withdraw from the case. That's 9 in the list, or in my version of the list. So the most mild level is the first one. Acknowledge the client's spontaneous statements of spiritual beliefs. Validate the language of moral concern when the client uses it spontaneously. So kind of the idea of validate rather than ignore. An example, a woman who was wanting to save her marriage made a comment, "The heart of God would be sad if I ended this marriage right now." And you, the worker, or Dougherty in this case, says, something like, that sounds important to you, like you have some real values behind what you're trying to do. That's good practice. That's connecting with the client. That's paying attention to the client. That's not ignoring this. But it's giving permission to say more if the client wants to say more. Another example. Non-custodial father of a school-aged children pondering whether to take a job in a city far away from his children, wondering whether the move would hurt his ability to be a good father. You might respond something, that sounds like a pretty important concern to me. Now the guy said it, or at least he's brought it up. Now you're not sure, you know, what all that means, but you are not ignoring that. You know, this is, you're just saying he's thinking about somebody besides himself in this decision, and you're making news of that. Okay, the next level, beyond just kind of not ignoring it or validating it when it comes up, is to more explicitly inquire about a client's spiritual beliefs or practice, or to introduce language to make more explicit the moral horizon of the client's issue or concern. And again, I would say this is part of a sensitive assessment. We would do a little or a lot of this depending on what the situation seemed to call for. At some point, it might be relevant to explore whether spirituality or religion are important in the client's lives, important in their thinking about the problems and how to get past them, the resources or barriers. A question like, do you have any beliefs that help you deal with things like this? And if the answer is no, then at this level, you move on. You don't try to make something happen that's not happening. So back to this father. The father above may be focusing on his relationship to his children and not the possible harm to them, the importance of his one-way commitment to them. And you might say something like, yes, they may feel that you're walking out of their lives by moving away. Now, that's not just a neutral response on your part. I mean, that's language to make more explicit the moral horizon. You know, because he's been mainly talking about his relationship, and you're at least, say, making a response that raises the possibility that the impact on them is something to be thinking about as well. And, you know, I just need to say at this point that, you know, he's aware of the fact that, you know, there is no neutral way to respond to things like this. You know, he argues that the last, 40 years of history and psychotherapy and so on has been full of teaching and preaching a very individualistic value system that does not consider the impact of my actions on other people, But it's really kind of Fitz Perls thing, you know, I do my thing, you do your thing, and if it all works out well, that's cool. Well, he's saying that we do have moral responsibility to other people in our lives, especially people that we've made promises to or that we've brought into this world as our children. All right, number three, inquire about how the client connects the spiritual, clinical, and moral dimensions of his or her life or problems. Ask questions about the client's perceptions of the consequence of their actions on others. Explore the personal, familial, or cultural sources of these moral sensibilities. So, a few examples. How the client thinks that the beliefs and practices ought to relate. And he gives this example, and I've experienced this one as well. A woman who's a caregiver for a demented husband. You ask the question, what role does your faith play in your decision to keep your husband at home as long as possible? You know, you might be thinking to yourself, you know, she's keeping him at home way too long, you know. And so you're raising the question, you know, what kind of connection does her spiritual beliefs and moral beliefs have a part in this? And, you know, then it remains to be seen what kind of conversation you would have about this. Continuing on with the same one, another example. A woman who suddenly left her second husband and moved into a small apartment where her teenage children could not live, leaving them with their stepfather. In other words, the children of the first marriage had been left with the stepfather. She's moved out. Daughter in particular was very distressed. After empathetically listening to her story, you might say something like, when you were making a decision to leave, how did you think it would affect your children? And how do you think they feel now? And you're raising this up as something to think about as you're engaging in this problem exploration process. Are you imposing values on your client? I don't think so. Are you facilitating the discussion, helping them to make a more full consideration of their life at this point? I would argue it's probably pretty good practice. Okay, moving along.
David, two minutes.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, I'll just run through these. The fourth one is to express agreement with the client's spiritual beliefs or sensibilities when that's possible. It could be therapeutic, but only if it's authentic. Well, number five is to articulate the client's moral and spiritual dilemma without giving your own position. You know, it sounds like you're saying you're dealing with this and also this is involved. Especially if you're bringing out something that's implicit, but it would help them. And he gives a very powerful example here of parents of a gay son who were considering rejecting him permanently. We don't have time to go through that right now. Number five, articulate the client's moral spiritual dilemma without giving your position. In other words, just highlighting it. Number six, point out the contradictions or tensions, perhaps, that they're struggling with. You know, there is going to be a choice that has to be made. Number seven, bring research findings and clinical insight to bear on the consequences of certain actions, particularly for vulnerable persons. Now, here it's getting tricky, but, you know, where do you bring information? Where do you bring in things that they might want to consider? Number eight, this is getting pretty heavy duty, describe how you generally see the issue and how you tend to weigh the moral options. Emphasizing that every situation is unique and the client will, of course, make his or own decision. This is kind of high-stakes stuff, where you see the client looking like they're going down a road that you cannot, in good conscience, accompany them with. You know, this is a rare kind of a step to take. But he's saying that there could be times when this would be the ethical and competent and respectful thing to do to you, to yourself and to them. He gives an example that we don't have time to go through. The last one is the most strongest version of that, to challenge the client's way of handling the decision based on your beliefs and express why that is. And it may be withdrawing from the case. Now, you might think, well, no, you shouldn't do that. Well, you shouldn't do it right away. This should be a very last step. But I suspect that every social worker, if they're honest, will find some clients proposing some course of action that they cannot, in good conscience, go down that road with them. And so we're kind of out of time here, so we'll need to stop here. I do encourage you to look at the material in the handouts, and really appreciate your patience with this large group of 50-some people and me doing just about 99% of the talking.
David, thank you so much for your presentation today. For those of you who have participated, we'd love to hear your evaluation of today's audio conference and your suggestions about improving future conferences. I will send out later today a survey so that you can provide us feedback and, again, let us know how we can continuously improve the different trainings that we offer, hopefully many of them of the caliber and quality of David's. Secondly, for those of you who are interested in obtaining documentation for earning CEU contact hours, please download the 10 post-training questions that were posted on our website. There was information about how to access these in the email that confirmed your original registration, but if you need to get updated information on that, please don't hesitate to contact the NACSW office at info@nacsw.org. And then just a two-second commercial. Our next audio conference workshop will be scheduled for February 28th. That's a Monday at 1 p.m. at Eastern Standard Time. And the topic will be on sexual trafficking and the global sex industry, led by Lisa Thompson, coordinator for the Initiative Against Sexual Trafficking, a topic that's gotten more and more visibility both within the faith community and within the governmental community as well. Thank you all for joining us today, and we look forward again to receiving your feedback and you joining us again in the future. And take care then.